life better than bacon and lettuce and homegrown tomatoes. Up in the morning, out in the garden, get you ripe when you don't get a hard one. Plant them in the spring, eat them in the summer. All winter without them's a culinary bummer. I forget all about the sweating and digging every time I go out and pick me a pig. Homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes.
That's right, friends. It's time for another episode of In the Garden with Master Gardener Ed Bajarski and me here in the station at KFSK for you. And this program is brought to you in part by the Flower Farm at Papke's Landing and the Flower Farm Garden Center behind Island Flowers in downtown Petersburg, with ready-to-plant veggies, tomato plants with blooms, trees, shrubs, perennials, annuals, and more. Plus, they have organic black gold soil and organic compost. You can reach the Flower Farm at 772-3464.
Eat them with beans, pinto or navy. Put them on the side, put them in the middle. Put a homegrown tomato on a hot cake griddle. Homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes. What a life.
And we've got Ed Bajarski on the phone there. How are you, Ed?
Well, I'm pretty good, Oren. It's a little light sprinkle here, but we're supposed to have some nice, warm, sunny weather coming up. It's supposed to be a nice weekend, and my intentions are to get those tomatoes and cucumbers into the ground in my greenhouses.
Perfect.
But separately from that, talk about the dreaded creeping buttercups and their more tasteful and lovely relatives today.
Aha, yes. Yes, the creep of the buttercup. Yeah, what can folks do about that?
Well, it is among others, it is an invasive. It is native. It is actually European, supposedly, and who knows who brought it here? Whether it came in with seeds, perhaps, or whatever came in with hay and other things from down south. Certainly, I've seen them in pots that I bring up from down south. I try to weed them out, ideally down there first. But it is a problem, certainly in gardens. They spread both by seeds and by runners, like strawberries do. So they are extremely successful, and those seeds can lie dormant in the soil for, I've heard 50 to 100 years, and I've also heard 500 years, so that even though, you know, you may well be, dare I say, clearing a forest or clearing alders or otherwise, but you start turning over the soil, and suddenly, because they've become exposed to the light, they sprout and start to grow.
Wow.
So it is a challenging plant. It's a battle. It's an ongoing battle, certainly, that for probably most gardeners in Southeast Alaska and other places have. Trying to slow them down and or weed them out. They have a fairly wide-ranging root system, so they are, sometimes it takes a trowel or a dandelion digger or whatever your favorite tool might happen to be to loosen things up so you can pull them out.
Gosh, 500 years. That's a horror movie right there.
Right. They're just waiting dormant to see the light of day, you know. So, yeah, you turn over the soil, and surprise, there they are.
Yeah.
And again, maybe there was a garden. You know, some of these folks, old homesteads and that sort of thing. You know, they're certainly a common thing. And they're also, even though those are, that one is an invasive, non-native, we do have quite a number of species, wild native species here. Some are smaller than others. Some are quite tall. And then some of the relatives, there's some beautiful alpine buttercups. There's one called Cooley's buttercup that for those folks who are hikers and climbers and get up into the alpine areas, that these things grow. I mean, they flower just about 2 days, maybe 2 to 3 days after the snow melts off them. I mean, I've seen them on hiking up above Juneau here, where you can watch. You can almost watch the snow melting back on nice days, and there's nothing else sprouting, and then suddenly there's these beautiful, very short, they have big flowers, but very small plants with these nice little buttercups. And I don't know of anybody who has tried moving those into a garden, whether they would be good, bad, invasive, or otherwise. And there's taller anemones. We've got other native plants in Alaska, the different anemones and passflowers. There are native delphiniums in Alaska that I've seen growing in various places from north of Haines and even out on Admiralty Island and up into the Yukon and up into northern Alaska. Beautiful stuff. And then there's all of these domesticated versions. And the most common one, right there, just starting to bloom in my garden, that you'll probably see around around Petersburg, are the globe flowers, or trolleus, which really do look quite a bit like buttercups. But now there are some more selections now of different yellow, shades of yellow, orange, and even some cream-colored ones, not quite white, which are very nice. And again, those are much better behaved. Yes, some of them spread by seed somewhat, or others are usually can be divided potentially. Another good one, good relative, are the columbines. Mm. And the columbines come in, we have the native red and yellow one that the hummingbirds and bees love. Very hardy. I've seen them growing wild from Wrangell and Petersburg to Haines and far beyond that. Mm-hmm. And then the domesticated versions, which come in all colors of the rainbow, from white to the very darkest of purple, singles and doubles. And those are, they easily, again, the hummingbirds love them. They're a great plant to plant for those at a certain time. And you can collect seeds of them. However, because the birds and the bees like them so much, they fairly easily hybridize. So even though you plant purple columbines and maybe have some white ones, and who knows what your neighbor has, they may be hybridized by the bees and birds, and then you get different ones that are of in-between colors and shades and sizes.
Hmm. Huh. So that's interesting that they always kind of return to wild, kind of.
Well, yeah, there is a fair amount of that happening. It's depending on what sort of genetic makeup they have and what they were bred from. That does, the wild, it may be part of natural selection, too, in that the wild types may be more hardy, more better adapted to the conditions where we're planting them. I mean, certainly I've noticed that saving tomato seeds, or if you get tomato seeds sprouting out of your compost, even though you may have started out with big slicer tomatoes and other stuff, it seems like they all end up being cherry tomatoes. So again, it's a, you know, whether that's a genetic thing that happens that drives their survival, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So then there's the big stuff. Then there's the big stuff that, you know, we're kind of in Alaska is known for, the delphiniums, mm-hmm. and monkshood, which, of course, those are the spectacular stuff that can get to be 6 to 8 feet tall, depending on how much you feed them. And they also need, it's probably a good time even now to remind people to have your stakes and supports ready, because monkshood are nice because they usually have stiffer stems, don't get quite as tall, usually can stand up pretty strong by themselves. But delphiniums, it seems like, every year when they are just about to open their flowers, or once the first ones are open, we get wind and rain, and then they fall over or they snap off or something like that. So we really want to make sure we've got stakes or cages or something of that sort ready for them, so they will stand up tall and proud after the rain goes and hopefully the sun comes back out again. I mean, some of mine they're a foot tall already, and they're reaching for the sky. So I've got a new area that we did last year, and then we've got a semi-permanent trellis system there. So we'll see, and we'll probably fine-tune it some this year for those plants, because we know they have that tendency to fall over.
And our delphinium is one that was kind of an Alaska native wildflower,
yes.
That
yes.
You're kind of
harvesting. Yeah, and they still are. Yeah, I mean,
tamy.
If you go up going up the Haines Highway and going out on the Alaska Highway, up in the Yukon, I mean, I've seen them blooming. Normally, it's about mid to late June, roughly, when they flower. And up there, the wild ones, get up to be maybe 2 feet tall or a little taller than that. So then again, scientists or plant breeders, and they grow in other countries too. So they may very well have selected the tallest ones and then crossbred the tallest ones to get hopefully taller and taller ones. And usually in shades of blue, there are some sort of pinks, which are kind of mediocre, and whites also. But again, they are spectacular flowers, spectacular plants when they're in full flower. Something we try to grow and enjoy and maybe show off. And they make great cut flowers, too. Mm-hmm. So that's and something that you can even find at the florist shops very often is they'll have delphiniums at certain times of year from various places. And so they are a great cut flower.
So is there a kind of a certain wisdom in bringing your favorite wildflowers into your garden beds because they're going to be hardier for these climates, if kind of already proven it? Or is there kind of a fine line between having something that's going to take over your beds because it's so robust in this area versus, you know, like, how do you make those distinctions? And how do you
sometimes you have to do that individually. Some plants are protected, but you can normally collect seeds, and that's very often that's the best way and the most, you know, ecologically safe way of doing it, is to collect seeds and start them. The challenge is, like some of these that grow up in the Yukon, their conditions there are much different than here. And I've tried that, not really successfully with some of the plants. The other thing that may or may not happen, and again, like you say, bringing wild plants into the garden, we're going to be probably planting them into richer soil than they are used to. So whether that's going to cause them to become too vigorous, possibly, or sometimes it's too much fertilizer, which we see with certain plants anyway, that you know, they're just such rich that they grow so much out of bounds that they may have weak stems. Mm-hmm. So again, and that's a type of fertilizer issue, but it's also a soil issue and aspect. So for something like wild, again, going to some other plants that do pretty easily, you know, wild iris are something that are relatively easy to transplant and slow to grow from seed, where some of the others are more of a challenge. Side-by-side growing with them may be the shooting stars, and those are very slow to start from seed, and they like really wet conditions to start with. So matching up your garden conditions with the wild conditions where the plants are growing and thriving, that one too is a challenge. So again, and I guess part of it is being prepared. If you see that these plants appear to be becoming invasive, you know, maybe, and sometimes you hear this from gardeners, and say, oh yeah, I've got lots of that. You know, come on over and I'll give you a whole bunch of it for free. And then maybe it's worth asking the question, well, it's free because it's taking over your garden. So do I really want it in my garden to take over my space? So again, yeah, doing some research on these plants that you're bringing in, sometimes, oh, more than often, I don't. I see some plants at a nursery or at a plant sale, and oh, that's wonderful and looks beautiful, and hopefully I can talk to the knowledgeable owner or seller of these plants to find out about how they should be growing or how you should grow them or be careful because they might become invasive. So those are questions that you kind of should ask, unless you've got a brand new garden and it's all nothing but bare space and you just let it go wild.
Those are all good things to consider. And I love that it comes back to that. Really the best advice each time is if you fall in love with the plant, that plant has been cultivated by somebody who knows just how to cultivate it that well. And I'm they're more times than not eager to share that information and share the love of gardening that way. And so that's always
right.
A good thing to remember.
Yeah. I mean, gardeners aren't, well, sometimes gardeners get grumpy because they've just killed their favorite plant or they've been trying enough times and finally have to give up on it. But, you know, they're grumpy because the buttercups are taking over their yard. But usually they're willing to talk with other folks about how to grow, you know, a nice plant. You know, you admire their primroses or their delphiniums or something like that and say, hey, you know, come on back later on or in the springtime, you know, we can divide some up and you can have some for your yard. So that's definitely worthwhile. But, yeah, talking to the gardener, talking to a, hopefully a good nursery owner who is selling this stuff, as opposed to the big box stores, which, you know, those people haven't a clue as to how to grow most things. Put it in the ground and hope for the best, and just because we brought it to Alaska doesn't mean it's meant to grow in Alaska. Right. So, again, you know, you're making some choices, and gardening is, well, gardening has certainly become, if anything, more experimental each year as our weather changes, too. So, you know, some plants may thrive in a dry summer and die or get drowned or rot, get fungus infected in a wet summer. Mm-hmm. So, again, it's an experimental thing. You know, we keep reminding people, if you're not killing plants, you're not gardening.
Yeah, it's true. You know, the learning really never stops. You never reach the top in the journey to understand your own garden because, yeah, conditions change year after year.
Sure. I mean, conditions in Petersburg are different than different parts of Juneau are very different from cold to warm, wet to dry. You know, there's places that get twice as much rain around Juneau, at least. And certainly, I know Petersburg from town mm-hmm. out to Papke's Landing, there's a big difference in rainfall
oh, yeah.
and weather patterns. Mm-hmm. So, and whether you've got, you're gardening on straight muskeg or you've got sand and gravel and you're building garden beds on top of that, again, that's going to make a big difference in your success or failure mm-hmm. and what you can and can't grow.
Yeah. Well, why don't we, I'm going to open the phone line up here. If anybody out there is dying to put a question to you, this is the time that we can do that. 772-3808 if anybody is got something on the tip of their tongue that they're dying to have you answer. But this also might be a good time, if we don't get any calls, to move on to that next topic where you're talking about taking advantage of this sunny couple of days here to put your tomatoes and cucumbers in the soil and maybe just kind of doing a quick couple minutes of what's the best practice there and what's a pitfall that somebody should be aware of.
So I've gotten my plants pretty well hardened off. I actually have one more tray to move out, and that I'll just work on that. So I brought my plants out there on my back porch. It faces, let's see, northwest. It does have a clear cover on it, so it's bright, but it's sheltered, but not too bright to the hot sun over the past week or so. So I've been hardening those plants off. They're actually in the greenhouse right now. I threw some of the Remay, the horticultural fabric, over them again to kind of moderate conditions. So they're going to go in the ground. The tomato plants, some of those were, well, they're 18 inches tall. So some of those are going to get buried deeper. They're kind of going to be laid into a trench, kind of at an angle, like a 45-degree angle, and I'll be burying maybe a third to a half of the plant in them, with them. With the cucumbers and stuff, you really can't do that much. You can only slightly bury them a little bit more. Most of those at least have the 2 to 3 true leaves. They're at the perfect stage for transplanting. And as once I put them in, I will be watering them down with a dilute fertilizer solution. I've got some organic stuff, but Miracle-Gro can be used. But again, it's like half strength or less than the full dose that they, you know, read on the package. If it says it's a tablespoon per gallon, go to half as much or even a quarter as much.
Right.
Water the plant in and use some kind of slightly warmed, at least ideally room temperature or, you know, 60 degree temperature water. Don't water with the cold hose. So again, in my greenhouse I have buckets and barrels of water. So at least they moderate, you know, their temperature is more moderate than the stuff that comes out of the hose out of the ground, which is in more like the low 40s.
Right.
Because
that's
too, can shock.
Right.
Shock roots and shock plants.
Yep. That makes sense. And so you're wanting to avoid shocking. You're wanting to give them a little boost of strength as they're kind of taking hold. And for those tomatoes, what kind of spacing are you doing there as you're laying those kind of taller ones down?
That's the toughest part of all. You know, especially when these plants are small, you think, oh, you know, I plant these out there, they're 8. I try to aim for about 18 inches apart, and all of them I normally string up, or I have tomato cages or something like that. A little bit wider apart. Hard part is thinking ahead to end of July or August, when it's just this solid mass of green and hopefully some red peeking out of tomatoes in there. And you always think, at least this time of year, I'm planting these at 18 inches or 2 feet apart. And I say, gee, there's all that bare space in between. I could plant some more, and I know better. Yeah. I mean, otherwise you're pruning them back too severely later.
Yeah.
So you want to make sure that you will have space. It gives the roots more room to grow, of course, in there too. Although you can certainly provide them that with, even if you're doing hydroponic tomatoes or something. But again, you want space for the ventilation in between.
Right.
And with the cucumbers, I'm doing pretty much the same routine. And again, those two, I have strings that I hang from my top crossbars on my greenhouse. So the tomatoes, I mean, the cucumbers grow up the strings. And again, I'm pinching off the little side shoots on those. So make sure I have flowers and, you know, both male and female flowers for pollination at some point. Some of my tomatoes are blossoming. That's okay that they're doing that.
Yeah.
So then, but getting them in the ground and hopefully without too much shock. The cucumbers, you don't pop them out of the pot. Hopefully the roots are not too tight in the pot, they just hold the soil together, and you get them into the ground quickly, without much disturbance. They're quite sensitive. Where tomatoes, they can be pot bound in that pot, and you can hack and tear away the roots and get them in the ground, and you bury them half the depth of the plant, and they take off and grow like crazy. So there's much major difference between the two.
Right.
And if you're doing some other stuff, peppers and eggplant, those can be planted a little bit deeper than they are in that pot. Again, depending on varieties too, if you know how big your plant is supposed to get.
Right.
Or particularly if you kept track over the past years, you know how big these are going to get, whether they're going to need some extra staking or extra support too. But again, tomato cages, they last pretty much forever if you buy some. And certainly if you're fairly handy and have a saw, or you can make your own stakes out of alder sticks. And alder sticks and twist ties, you know, you can keep it as simple as you want.
Totally.
But they most generally need some support, particularly once they get a heavy fruit load. You don't want them sprawling on the ground with tomatoes on the ground, even though that's how my parents grew them long ago and far away in Upper Michigan. There wasn't any of that, but it was hot and stuff, and I actually get tomatoes earlier than they did here in my greenhouse.
Okay, well, that's a good set of tips, and we can talk more about that soon, but we have a caller with a question for you, so I'm going to pop over to the phone here. Hello there.
Hello.
Line one, you are on with Ed Bajarski.
Hello, Ed. Thanks for your information. I have a question regarding raspberries. What is the best fertilizer that you recommend? And then part two of the question, should I be nipping, tipping, cutting the buds off the top before they start to bud?
She sounds like she is very far away, like as far away as from here to across the parking lot, so I can hardly hear her. You may have to translate or transfer her question to me.
Okay, I'm going to try to change something up again. Would you mind asking that one more time? Let's see if we can get him here.
You bet. I have a question regarding raspberries, the best fertilizer for them, and should they be pinched off on the buds before they take off in their big spring growth?
Okay. So are you talking about the new growth, that is the growth that is coming from the stem, the canes that you left that grew last year? Or
yes.
Are you talking about pinching the new growth coming up from the base that will be for raspberries next year?
Well, the non-producers from last year will soon be budding out, and I have typically tried to keep them about 4 or 5 feet tall, but I've got some that are rather ambitious and heading up to 6 and 7 feet tall. But so I don't know if I should trim them back to keep a nice, 4 or 5 foot height on the...
Yeah, I mean, personally, I let mine grow as tall as they want, and that does mean 6 to 7, 8 feet tall. Of course, you need support for them, some kind of trellis or wires or something to support them.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, I suppose maybe you need how tall a person to pick. But for convenience, if you do prune them all off to, say, 5 feet tall, that sometimes that does help because then you have the stiffer stems. So they are less likely to bend over, particularly when we get the heavy rains or otherwise. The key here is we want them supported, the berries supported well up off the ground so that they don't get moldy and or slugs get to them. So it's going to be your choice whether you want to have a fairly uniform height on them. Like I said, I don't mind having them that high. The other thing that happens, of course, you have some spacing of blooming time, although there isn't that much difference. So you've got basically your raspberries you're going to be picking over, say, a three-week period, hopefully starting 1st of August or maybe a little earlier. This year might be a little later just because it's been cooler. We'll see what happens. But that's one thing where the topmost buds will be the later flowering ones also. So, again, that kind of may space out your harvest, too. So I don't know if that's a benefit or if you just as soon pick them all, get them turned into jam, jelly, frozen berries, whatever it happens to be in a shorter period of time because there's something else coming along like blueberries or huckleberries or otherwise that you pick.
Okay. What kind of fertilizer do you recommend for raspberries?
Very light doses. I mean, once mine are established, and I did way back when I planted mine 3 to 4 years ago, I started with a layer of composted horse manure, a layer of topsoil on top of that, a light sprinkling of a balanced organic fertilizer, which may, and that's optional for you. And you can use, the other thing you can use too as a fertilizer, because they like acid conditions, acid soil, like strawberries, like potatoes, like rhododendrons and evergreens. So you could actually use a very light dose of that rhododendron evergreen food, whether it's organic or non-organic, but lightly. I mean, do fertilize lightly. And for me, I am primarily fertilizing with seaweed. I haul truckloads of seaweed in the fall, and I pile it around the raspberry plants and my blackberries too, and that's pretty much all they get. And, of course, then that breaks down over the course of the year, and then the next year I'll do it again.
Okay.
So they're not heavy feeders. So other than the initial getting them started and growing well, after that you don't need to fertilize them very much.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Okay. You're very welcome.
Yeah, thanks for your call. All right.
I'm looking forward. I see there are flower buds on the raspberries as we speak. So with this sunny weather that's forecast, they might start blooming here this over this weekend and beyond. And that is certainly something that the bees just go wild. They love. There must be a lot of nectar there for the from those raspberries. Certainly, contrasting, I've got my blackberries are right next to them. The bees will definitely rather go to the raspberries first over the blackberries, even though the blackberries have a bigger, whiter flower. And maybe they need that to attract the bees because the raspberries, they're less fancy flower, but more attractive to the bees, certainly.
They can smell that sweetness.
I guess so.
Cool. Well, we're a little out of time today, so if there are people out there with questions in mind, we might have to save them for next week, but we will be at it again next week. And, Ed, I just want to thank you so much for taking the time, and I hope everybody is going to take advantage of this nice, dry weather that we have for the next few days. Sunny sometimes and a little bit cloudy other times, so combined, absolutely perfect for spending long stretches outside. And hope everybody takes advantage of it, and I'm sure you'll be really busy up there. And
undoubtedly, and trying to get enough sleep in between working till late or early or whatever, or get my afternoon nap in so I can keep on going.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, Ed, it's a pleasure, as always, and I look forward to talking to you next week.
All right. Will do.
Okay. Till then. Thanks again, Ed.
All right. Bye, Arne.
Bye-bye. All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening out there. That was In the Garden with Master Gardener Ed Bajarski and myself. We want to thank the Flower Farm, one of the sponsors of this program. They're out there at Papke's Landing, and they have the Flower Farm Garden Center behind Island Flowers in downtown Petersburg with tomato plants, with blooms ready to plant, and other veggie starts, too, and a whole lot more, plus organic black gold soil and organic compost. You can call the Flower Farm at 772-3464. We'll be back next week with another episode of In the Garden.
Only two things that money can't buy, and that's true love and homegrown tomatoes. Well, you can go out to eat, and that's for sure, but it's nothing a homegrown tomato won't cure. Put them in a salad, put them in a stew. You can make your very own tomato juice. You can eat them with eggs. You can eat them with gravy. Eat them with beans, pinto or navy. Put them on a side. Put them in the middle. Put a homegrown tomato on a hot cake griddle.
Homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes. What would life be without homegrown tomatoes? Only two things that money can't buy, and that's true love and homegrown tomatoes. Tomato seed, 'cause I know what this country needs. It's homegrown tomatoes in every yard you see. When I die, don't bury me in a box in a cemetery. Out in the garden be much better, and I could be pushing up homegrown tomatoes.
Homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes. What'd life be without homegrown tomatoes? Only two things that money can't buy, and that's true love and homegrown tomatoes. Homegrown tomatoes, what'd life be without homegrown tomatoes? Only two things that money can't buy, and that's true love and homegrown tomatoes.